This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. For our kids' childhoods, we wish for a happy, loving home, caring teachers, good schools, and good friends. But growing up and coming of age involves work and struggle, anxiety, sometimes anguish. And if somehow you stand out from your peers, the work of growing up can be tougher. For example, being the only black child in the classroom and living in a neighborhood that is, with the exception of one neighbor, all white. Our guest this afternoon is Jennifer Bazile. As a girl, she was not the girl next door. She was the black girl next door. And that is the title she's chosen for her memoir about growing up and coming of age in the 1970s and 80s, living in a suburb of Los Angeles. Bazile's parents had been part of the generation that came of age during the Civil Rights Movement. Her father knew the cruelties of the Jim Crow South. Both strove to succeed in order to make the American dream a reality for themselves and their daughters. Today, Jennifer Bazile belongs to a generation of African Americans for whom integration is nearing reality. Bazile writes in her memoir, "My achievements were weapons, the tools of conquest my parents used in the long siege against prior generations of exclusion and refusal." Listeners, I invite you to join our conversation this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Jennifer Bazile, is a graduate of Columbia and Princeton. She was the first black female professor to join Yale University's history department. Her memoir, The Black Girl Next Door, is a touchstone book published by Simon and Schuster. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Jennifer Bazile, so good to talk with you. How are you?
It's great to be here. I'm doing very well. Thanks
good,
so much.
Good. Well, one of the things you knew as a little kid, as a six-year-old girl, was that it was important at home and in school to stay on track.
Yes.
How was that message delivered, and why was it so important?
Well, you know, like so many African Americans, the move to the middle class was really a very steep climb. My parents were both born into families, working poor families. And so in order for them to move up to this community called Palos Verdes, this set of communities called Palos Verdes Peninsula, they had to earn the money. There was nobody to call with a trust fund to ask for the down payment on the house. And so when my parents moved from the all-black suburb of Carson, California, to Palos Verdes, California, the suburb where I grew up, it was a matter of relentless effort. So my parents both had full-time jobs, and then they had secondary jobs. My mom did real estate, and my father ran a series of retail businesses. So staying on track wasn't just a matter of what they told us. Staying on track was what we lived every day, because they worked literally 7 days a week.
Yeah. So it was important day-to-day, and it was important long-range.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Tell us something more about your parents, Janet and Barry.
Well, you know, my father grew up in the segregated South. He was born in 1937, which makes him 71, going on 72. And he grew up in southwestern Louisiana, right over the Texas border, in what many people know as Cajun country. Small town, literally divided by a set of railroad tracks. So black people lived on the side of the tracks with the unpaved streets, and the white people lived on the side of the other side of the tracks with the paved streets. Went to what they called at the time colored schools. and lived there until he was about 14 years old when he went to high school in Port Arthur, Texas. Now, my mother grew up in Detroit, Michigan. Her family had migrated to work in the Ford factories, the Henry Ford factories, when Ford was offering $5 a day. And they had been sharecroppers and laborers, and they moved up to the northern edge of Detroit, Michigan. And they were people who really were trying to work their way into land ownership and home ownership. And in many cases, they did that. But the struggles were still very real.
Hmm. And how did they meet?
An aunt knew my father in California. And when my father was serving in the military back in Boston, Massachusetts, he drove, took a road trip, and got to know my mother in Detroit, Michigan. They fell in love, decided to get married, and headed off to California and got married on the way in Columbus, Ohio.
You know, writing this book and talking with your parents about all of this, what has that meant for the relationship between the three of you?
Well, you know, I think that in so many ways it has drawn us closer because there was so much about the experience that I had as a girl that they really didn't know or understand. And I think that this is very much common in people of my generation, particularly African Americans. You know, it's a little known fact, I think, or I would say I would argue, that for African Americans, we have a very particular definition of child rearing success. The less our children's childhood looks like ours, the better we think we're doing. So by my parents' standards, I didn't grow up in working poverty. Mm. I didn't grow up in segregation. We lived in a beautiful community beside the ocean. I went to one of the best schools in the state of California. And so by the standards of their childhoods, my childhood looked great. The book was part of the way that I helped my parents understand that integration had been a very complicated, very difficult slog, that in some ways their own childhoods, their own experiences as adults made it difficult for them to understand. Mm. But I think that the book helped.
Yeah. For example, maybe in for our audience who haven't yet read the book,
mm-hmm.
You would talk about this sixth grade dance where this is a human look at your experience of integration, both preparing for the dance, going to the dance, and dancing.
Well, you know, here's the thing. So often we think about history as those big ceremonial moments like the inauguration. Those are the moments that we think about as historic. But that's not the way that most of us experience or participate in history. We experience and participate in history in everyday life, in the seemingly small and inconsequential ways. So, you know, part of the way that I learned about race, part of the way that I learned about how I was different, was by going to the makeup counter with one of my friends who was white. And she had a great makeover experience. She looked dewy-skinned and beautiful. All of her pimples were covered. And then when it was my turn, I was hoping for the same result, but there was no makeup at the department store nearest my house that looked good on my skin. And so exclusion at that moment wasn't about a lunch counter. It wasn't about a proposition or a courtroom battle. It was about me not feeling pretty in that moment. And when we went to the dance, our first dance of intermediate school, which is what they call it, middle school, mm-hmm. in sixth grade, you know, it was the harsh reality that no one was asking me to dance. You know, I had known how to dance because my sister and I watched Soul Train every weekend. But it was that uncomfortable moment when my girlfriend, who got the great transformation look at the makeup counter, got asked to dance on fast dances and on slow dances. And I was standing there on the sidelines, no one asking me to dance, and I finally got up the courage to ask someone to dance, but got turned down quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the school dance became another frontier in integration. And that's part of where I, like so many people, learned our lessons about what was possible and what wasn't possible.
Yeah. And with that guy that you danced with, you kind of toned it down. You forgot Don Cornelius's moves, and you went for Dick Clark.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I think that many of your listeners, whether they're African American or not, they all have those moments in their childhoods when they realize that they stand apart from their peers, when they stick out when they don't want to stick out. The difference for me growing up in the 70s and 80s in this overwhelmingly white suburb was that I was sticking out all the time, and I was sticking out without a lot of answers to the questions that I was asking. Why did we move here? Mm-hmm. What are we doing here? I didn't get a lot of good answers. And my peers and I really were trying to figure out what integration was going to mean for us, because integration is really the story of childhood.
Hmm. Did you have African-American friends? Were they few and far between?
Well, you know, I did have some African-American friends, but there weren't a lot of African-American people mm-hmm. in the community where I grew up. But it was very interesting because when I was in seventh grade, we went on a cruise, and it's one of the stories I tell in the book. And it was a moment when my parents came face to face with their tremendous anxiety about their choice to have us live this full contact, integrated life.
Mm-hmm.
And it coincided with adolescence. And when my parents were on that ship, they got infuriated with us because they said, you know the names of the white kids on this boat, but you don't know the black kids. And so they locked us out of the cabin, my sister and I, and said, don't come back until you know the names of every black kid on this ship. And we did it. So after we got back to California, my parents met with the handful of other African-American parents in these surrounding towns, and they formed a new organization to try and help their kids. But it was really an organization formed out of pride as much as it was formed out of anxiety for what they had chosen for us.
Mm. Assimilation has its costs. Your parents' anxiety, the solidarity that being together has. One of the moments that I was stunned by in the book is back in, I think, sixth grade, and it involves the dance when there's one African-American boy who's your age, and you don't know one another.
Right. Right. You know, that's another one of those moments when everybody is just doing what they can to try and fit in. And on the one hand, it seems perfectly logical that we would dance together. But then on the other hand, can you imagine the assumptions that would have been made about us as individuals, about us as a couple? You know, it's a very, very difficult moment,
mm-hmm.
you know. And adolescence, you know, who wants to be 12 or 13 trying to figure out these issues that adults really have not been able to figure out for this country? That was really the price and the terrible burden that white and black kids of my generation bore for this country. Mm-hmm. We were figuring this stuff out, how to negotiate these barriers that had been in place for hundreds of years. We were figuring out this stuff on the dance floor in a suburban California cafeteria.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it happened. That's where it unfolded. We think about the arc from Martin Luther King to President Obama, but we don't really talk about the stones that paved the way to that moment.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about history now, I'm thinking about, you know, who are you going to be in the American Heroes Parade?
Exactly.
Another great story. Would you tell it?
Well, absolutely. You know, what happened was I had learned a version of slavery at home. And the version of slavery that I had learned at home included watching the miniseries Roots with my mother and my sister. It had included putting up on the wall the only two family pictures that were in our house until I graduated from high school. And they were the pictures of my great-great-grandmother and great-great-grandfather who had both been enslaved. We didn't talk about the slave masters in our family. We just talked about the enslaved people, not as slaves, but as ancestors. When I got to school in fourth grade, I had the very painful lesson of learning the textbook version of slavery and the Civil War. And I was horrified by what I saw. It was a picture and a paragraph that I really felt shameful about. But the worst part of that moment was that I realized that if it had been 1860, 1859, all the kids in the class would have been free, and I would have been the only slave in that class. And so it was a huge divide. So when fifth grade, my teacher, my favorite teacher, said, "We're going to have a parade of American heroes," I wanted to be Harriet Tubman because I wanted to speak back to that picture and that paragraph. I wanted to show the face of pride in slavery. But my teacher and my mother encouraged me instead to march in the parade as Rosa Parks. And I think that part of the reason that they did that was because they didn't want me to have to carry the burden of educating my whole fifth grade class about who Harriet Tubman was and about slavery. Mm. And, you know, I was heartbroken. And at first, I really wanted to march as Harriet Tubman. That was the thing that I wanted. But I ended up marching as Rosa Parks and was glad that I did because I got to see an extraordinary woman in seemingly, well, an ordinary woman in extraordinary circumstances really make change. But, you know, there was part of me that longed to be Harriet Tubman, but it was that horrible moment again, a kid-sized moment when you're 11 years old and you can't be the hero that you want to be because there's this broader context that you're not responsible for and that you didn't create, but you have to answer to.
Yeah, and you still have to teach your fellow students about Rosa Parks.
Yes, and sometimes you have to teach your teachers. Now, fortunately, in fifth grade, I didn't have to teach my teacher. But the previous year and in other contexts, I did have to do a kind of teaching that at the time I shouldn't have had to do.
Yeah. Mrs. McCormick, is she why you became a historian?
Yeah, you know, in a large part, she really is. She is terrific, and she bought the book and emailed me to say, "I remember that moment."
Wow.
So, you know, it really came full circle for me.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Jennifer Bazile. She's a historian. As a girl, she was not the girl next door. She was the black girl next door. And that is the title she's chosen for her memoir about growing up and coming of age in the 1970s and 80s, living in a white suburb of Los Angeles. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, my name is Celeste Quinn. I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, I noticed on some of the materials that came with the book that you've done a couple of speaking engagements or book signings in California.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like? And did you kind of go back to your old neighborhood and look around?
Well, you know, it was a very strange experience. My mother and my father, my sister, her two children, and my son were all in Washington, D.C. for President Obama's inauguration.
Yeah.
When I was in California doing these book events. And so I stayed in the house where I grew up. It's, you know, been redesigned and all the rest. But, you know, it's the same house. And it was a strange experience going back. It really was. I mean, I've been back since. But it was a very curious kind of experience. On the one hand, and the greatest part about the events in California was that people were ready to talk.
Hmm.
White people, Asian Americans, Latinos, African Americans, people from the West Indies, people from Africa were ready to have a kind of conversation that I hadn't really heard a lot of before. And it wasn't the statistics and the information. It was a bunch of people connecting around varied stories of what integration meant for them.
Mm.
And that was the most rewarding part of the experience in California.
Mm. And meanwhile, the rest of your family's in Washington, D.C. What was that time like for them?
Well, you know, for a man like my father, who grew up in the segregated South, who literally faced violence and torture at the hands of people because of his skin color. It was a transforming kind of moment. I don't know if my father thought that this day would ever come before he passed. He's still alive, by the way. And so, you know, it was just a momentous occasion. And one of the things that my mother did was she took the pictures of the ancestors that I had grown up with, and she had her grandchildren walk around Washington, D.C., and take pictures with the ancestors at the Lincoln Memorial and other places to really commemorate the moment for them as well as for our entire family.
And your son and your sister Natalie's children, how old are these kids?
My son is six. My sister's children are 13 and 10.
Wow. What a day.
Yeah, you know, a lot has changed. But for as much as that moment was exciting and undeniably historic, you know, these kids now still have to go back to the neighborhood, to the school. And they have to make decisions in their everyday lives. They have to learn lessons in their everyday lives about who they're going to be. And that is where real transformation happens. It's not just at the symbolic level. Symbols are important, but it's not just at the symbolic level. You know, one of the things that makes me very proud as a parent is the school that my son attends, they learn the Negro National Anthem. They just learn it. So he's already learning it. It's a public school. He's already learning it, and he's six. Whereas I didn't learn that song until I was 15. And it was a very powerful moment for me as his mother to hear him just humming the tune and working on the words around the house.
Mm. I was completely unaware that such a piece of music existed.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed it does. Mm. But, you know, the thing that makes it so wonderful is not just the black kids learn it at his school. Everybody learns it. And so it's just one of those moments of sharing that can occur now that weren't at least in place in the community where I grew up as a girl.
Yeah. One of the sentences that I struggled with a little in my introduction when I was thinking about how I wanted to introduce you was this. Today, Jennifer Bazell belongs to a generation of African Americans for whom integration is, what should I say, is a reality? No. Is nearing reality? That's what I chose.
Mm.
Because it seems to me that for a lot of reasons we're not there.
Well, you know, I think that this is a question for everybody in America. You know, we go back to symbols. Is America integrated because our leader is African-American? Because the first family is African-American? There's a black family living in the White House. Is that our measure of integration? What is the measure of integration? Mm-hmm. What are we really defining as success? You know, for my generation, so often integration meant tokenism. You know, it meant isolation. And the trade-off for people of my generation and for our parents was isolation for excellence, that you had to choose. You couldn't have both. And the question that I think we're confronting as a nation is, can we have both? And if we can, how does it look and how does it work?
And as you look at those two questions, what do you want it to look like? What do you hope? How do you hope it will work?
Well, you know, here's the thing. In some ways, I think that the question today is not about the black girl next door, although I think that there is still a profound degree of residential segregation. There's segregation in worship. And all kinds of ways in this country where African Americans and white people are concerned. But, you know, my concern and my question is really about the Muslim girl next door and the little Latina girl next door. And this is part of the story of how things can really change and shift in this country. It's not that quote-unquote race relations always stay one way. And so what I am hoping for in the first instance is for a kind of honest conversation to emerge in this country about where we have been so that we can really be in the present moment and make the most of it, being more forthcoming and honest about how we are connected, but also how we're divided. And I think that honest conversation can be the basis for so much transformation.
Mm. And I think what's exciting about right now is that we're finding ourselves ready to come to the table.
Exactly.
Whereas before we couldn't even get through the door.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that there's a long tradition in American life of refusing to talk about that which we think is too painful about the past. And it really binds us in the present. That's the trick. It's not just that the past, you know, you've got to learn, you know, relearn the history. Every generation's got to make its own peace with history. It's the way in which the past binds us in the present. And that was something that, as I was writing the book, became so clear for me about what segregation had done in this country. Because when I walked through the door with my white girlfriend, we were 7, 8, 9 years old. Imagine what her mother's experience is like when her daughter asks her, can Jennifer stay for dinner? And she has grown up in a segregated town where she thinks that segregation is supposed to be the rule. Then you've got a black girl eating tuna casserole at your table. And so, you know, I think that this idea of coming to the table, that is really so much of where transformation and change really lives in this country.
For your parents, it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong about this, so speak up, but it seemed that achievement brought so much. It could bring so much, but yet it couldn't bring deliverance. Is that fair?
I mean, I think that it is. I mean, I think that, you know, achievement was a way, again, it's one of those burdens of the past. You know, when I was growing up, my parents said to me, one of the few things that they said was, when we were growing up, what we wanted most was the chance to compete. The price of segregation was exclusion from even the opportunity. You couldn't even take the field to participate in the competition. You couldn't do it. And so for them, that is part of the reason why achievement was so loaded. And I think that achievement was also loaded and so important for them because it was a way of talking back to the indignities that they and that my other ancestors and relatives have suffered for so long, but that we didn't talk about. Mm. And so it was a way of talking back to so much. But it couldn't bring freedom because we were always looking in the rear view. We were always engaging but not describing that indignity that had happened in the past. And so it became a burden as much as it became a kind of opportunity.
Yeah. There's a scene in the book, a story in the book, where you have recently moved to Palos Verdes Estates and vandals have defaced the property. And the first time it happens, you and your dad work together to erase it. And the second time, he doesn't. He says no.
Right.
Have you talked with your dad about that? About that? What was going on then, and why he said the second time, no, Jennifer?
Well, you know, okay. Well, let me just explain for your listeners what had happened.
Sure.
We moved into this more exclusive, more well-heeled community called Palos Verdes Estates, and these were business owners and law partners and aerospace executives living in this place. And one morning, we had a fountain outside our house, behind a gate, little cherub head, and I loved that fountain, and one morning my mother walked outside and saw that somebody had painted black enamel paint on that cherub head. And my dad and I washed that off together. We worked together. A few weeks later, somebody put outside the walkway in front of our gate, "Go home, niggers." And on that occasion, after my father called the local paper and the local police and the FBI, he wouldn't let me help him. And we talked about it. And I think that what happened for my dad was that he didn't want me to bear that burden. He didn't want me to have to clean up, literally, clean up someone else's mess. He didn't want me to have to wipe away those words. He did it. But as much as he did the work, he couldn't shield me from the lesson.
Right.
In that moment. And, you know, it was a very heartbreaking moment for me, not just because someone had defaced our property and, you know, called me a nigger and called my family niggers. It was that it was a moment when I saw the limits of my parents' protection. For as much as they hoped, they hadn't been able to prevent this from happening. And for as much as these were country club, tennis playing, wealthy, educated people in California where bad things weren't supposed to happen, this had happened. And it wasn't 1947. It was 1976, 1977. I'm only 39 years old. And I think that the impulse is to say, that kind of stuff happened in the South. That kind of stuff happened a long time ago. Not that happened within the living memory of someone who is not yet in her middle age.
Thinking back to this election, this past election, I'm really sorry my mom didn't live to see Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail.
Yeah, you know, it was really just so empowering to see what happened, to see the kind of change that people were willing to support, not just symbolically, but with bumper stickers and buttons and, you know, $5 at a time. I think that that was the thing that really was indicative of how much had really changed. Mm-hmm. You know, even if we add Sarah Palin in there, it was a very interesting kind of moment in this country that I think people who lived it will not soon forget.
Yeah. Well, I'm in my 50s, and I remember being told as a girl, and I had no idea I would wind up doing the job that I'm doing today, of course, but I remember hearing men on the radio saying women had no business being on the radio.
You know, it's so wonderful when we can look back at moments like those that were painful and hurtful and look at our present lives and see what we have managed to accomplish. But by the same token, you know, part of the reason why I wanted to tell this story and part of what I hear when other people share their stories with me is the price and the sacrifice that often attends that wonderful transformation. Pioneering thing has a cost to it.
Yeah. I remember as a 5-year-old in kindergarten, in the classroom, there were little areas, like little vignettes. There was a kitchen and a workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted so much to get my hands on those tools. And I couldn't.
Yeah, you know, we don't think often enough about the powerful lessons that we learn in school, not at the desk necessarily, but in the school context. We learn so much more than information at school. We learn so much more about possibilities and what's off limits to us. And I think that that is both the power, but also the challenge in education for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And for adults, really. I think more adults than for kids.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite teachers was an economist, and God knows I couldn't do that. But you became a historian. I did not become an economist. But he was marvelous. I was late in my teen years, and he said, when we hold one person back, we hold everyone back. Mm. And he was one tough old ex-Marine guy.
Mm. You know, I think that so often what we all want is to have someone see the light in us, to see the possibility in us. And, you know, that person doesn't have to look the way that we look. That person doesn't have to sound the way that we sound. But, you know, we all have that desire to really make that honest connection with someone. And I wish I could say that I had more teachers like that growing up. But I was blessed with a few. Another one of my powerful experiences in the classroom is not part of the book. But, you know, it was in college when I had my first black teacher. I want to say that again. I had my first black teacher in college. I had to travel all the way across the country from California to New York to go to Columbia University in order for me to encounter my first black teacher. And the gift that she gave me was she taught me the power of a question. And I had been a little girl who had a lot of questions, but who found out early that the questions that I was asking about why did we move here, about what are we doing here, I found out early that those questions made my parents nervous. It made them uncomfortable to answer. What I understand now is, for African Americans of many generations, the past is no place for children. We are not nostalgic people. We don't look back and say, weren't the 50s great? But it means that we remember, but we withhold a lot of the stories. You know, that ancestor of mine, Mary Dean Ballard, when people used to ask her, what about slavery? When her own grandchildren would ask her, what about slavery? Her response was always the same. You don't want to hear about that. And so there is remembrance and recollection in African American culture, but there's not nostalgia. And part of the reason to tell the story, part of the reason for your readers, for your listeners to tell their stories, is to say that we are stronger than the worst things that have happened to us. Mm. And that we don't have to bear the burden for what happened. That's not ours necessarily. I don't carry the weight of segregation on my shoulders anymore. But part of the way that I've been able to free myself from that is by taking the power of telling the story of integration, its possibilities as well as its limitations.
What led you back to your childhood, and what led you to write it down, and what led you to say, here's a story, I want to look at this, and well, I want to tell it?
You know, here's what happened. I was teaching at Yale University. I had lots of really brilliant, great students who could reflect back to me information, but there was a connection that felt like it was missing. They couldn't really connect with history. They could memorize, they could recite, but they could not really connect. And I was really bothered by this, and I started to ask myself, why is their connection at the level of information bothering me so much? And then I realized that I was a person, a professional historian, hiding out in the distant past, who was avoiding her own history by telling other people's history. And I started to ask myself, well, what's the history that I'm not telling? And I realized the history that I wasn't telling was the history of integration. And the first thing that I did as the lonely, only black female professor in this big department at Yale University, the first thing I did was I went looking for the book that would tell my story. And I really wanted to find that book, but I couldn't find it. I could find other memoirs, I could find slave narratives, there are all kinds of other books that I could find, but I couldn't find the story of integration. I couldn't find the story of the black girl next door. And so that's when I started to write.
Our guest this afternoon, historian Jennifer Bazell, author of The Black Girl Next Door. It is a memoir about growing up and coming of age in the 1970s and 80s, living in a white suburb of Los Angeles. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a A brief comment. I think the thing that has made a difference since Obama's inauguration is that all of us realize, or I don't know all of us, but I certainly realize how much more profound the African American experience is. And I mean, one knows about it in broad outlines. Now suddenly everybody's talking, and you realize that this is much more than books. It's much more than anything. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say, because I've discovered this in the last couple of weeks. It's just everything seems to have changed in terms of African-American contacts, of which I have some.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Jennifer, you want to comment?
Well, you know, I really appreciate your listener's call. You know, I think that the thing is, there's a difference between the past and the way that we in any generation tell it. And I think that African American culture and history has always been rich. It has always been textured. There have always been great examples of integration, true cooperation in this country. But the question has been, what have we as historians and as readers and as listeners and students, what have we chosen to tell and what have we chosen to ignore? And I think that the excitement of this moment that your caller is connecting with is that the stories are emerging, but the stories are not new. The stories have been there. It's just that people have their ears and their eyes and, most importantly, their hearts open in a different way.
Hmm. Nothing wrong with our hearing all this time, but now we're listening.
Exactly.
Okay, let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line two. Hi.
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 Just a brief aside before I get to my main comment. If you and I had been going to school together, I probably wouldn't have asked you to dance at that sixth grade dance because I would have been too shy. So at least for a percentage of those boys, that was probably the case. My main thing, though, is my wife and I have adopted two boys from Korea and a daughter from China. The boys are in their early teens now, and they've both at some point or another come to me and complained about racist treatment from other kids. And sooner or later, I have to fall back on, I say to them, well, kids are inherently mean, and that they picked on me because I was skinny and wore glasses, and they're gonna find something. The fact that they're picking on you because you're Asian is just because that's the easiest thing for them to do. And I just wondered if you'd want to comment on that and any experiences you had like that. And I'll hang up.
Okay. Nice question.
Yeah, you know, I think that the thing that kids want when they come to their parents with those painful moments is they want their parents to really listen. And the first thing that I wanted when I had experiences like that was not for my parents to dust me off and say, go back out there and don't worry about it. I didn't want them to minimize it. I really wanted them to say, that is a rotten thing that happened. I wanted the acknowledgement. And I think that so often when we can tell our kids the truth in an age-appropriate way about the hard things that are happening to them and not diminish it, but just let it sit there for a minute, I think that kids can make their own sense with their parents' help of what is really happening. But, you know, it is the same thing to be picked on because you're skinny, and it isn't the same thing to be picked on because you're Asian. You know, those are different things. And it's part of the challenge of this moment to help our kids and ourselves really navigate through those very uncomfortable moments. And I appreciate what he said about the dance and, you know, shyness being the reason.
Last question, because we've got to wrap up here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've got your 6-year-old son and your sister Natalie's two children, 13 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are among the kids paving the next stretch of highway. What's on their minds at the moment?
Well, you know, I think that they are asking many of the same questions that we were asking, in part because the textbooks still have not caught up with the lived experience that they're having right now. And so part of the thing that they are asking about is, why doesn't the picture match the reality? That's certainly one question my own son has asked me. And, you know, I think that, again, kids don't learn about the big issues the way that we think they do. They learn about the issues at the school dance, at the makeup counter, in the pages of their textbook, in the conversations that they hear around the dinner table about politics. That's where kids get educated, truly educated. And I think that they will discover a new set of questions and a new set of answers. I know that my son is asking questions about, you know, the ongoing war and lots of other things. So there are still plenty of questions and concerns on their minds.
Yeah. The Black Girl Next Door leaves off as you finish up high school. Is there going to be a book coming out where the cover will say, by the author of?
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
I am at work on it now.
All right. Well, I hope to talk with you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Jennifer Bazell has been my guest, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of The Black Girl Next Door. It is a Touchstone book published by Simon & Schuster.